Good afternoon, good evening, and good day. This is Lance White, the host, Zany Mystic, for a Fireside Chat. We have a really exciting show for you today, and this is going to be kind of an unusual one. My guest today is going to be Philip Mantle. He's best known for the CD and his work with Alien Autopsy. So it's a DVD that tells the story of one researcher's 12-year investigation into one of ufology's greatest questions. Philip Mantle tells the story of his research. We talk to those involved with the alleged hoaxing of the film, and we look at the facts that lead one researcher to believe there are strange things within the alleged Alien Autopsy films that tell a different story. And I'm sure he has a lot of other stories to tell, too. So let's say hello to Philip. How are you, Philip?
Oh, good evening. I'm fine, thank you.
Good. I'd like to know, just for my own curiosity, how did you get started in ufology, and what prompted you to be so involved?
Well, Lance, I mean, as far back as I can remember, I always had an interest in all things that I would say paranormal. You know, as a young boy, and I was the one in the class who was always stand up and question everything. When other guys were going to the, you know, to the baseball match, you might say, or the soccer game,
no.
I was in the spiritualist church asking questions, you know.
Wow.
And sort of running parallel to that, I also had an interest in astronomy and the space program.
Wow.
So there was a point at somewhere in the late, I would say late 1970s, the two tended to sort of merge into one. A friend and I were in the West Country, the west of England, and we'd gone to use a telescope there that was built by a chap there. Now, one evening, I can't remember if it was cloudy or whatever, so we couldn't use the telescope, and I was reading a book on an astronomy which had one chapter dedicated to UFOs. Basically, dismissed them as nonsensical. But to my surprise, it mentioned a small town called Warminster in Wiltshire, which was quite near to where we were staying, and apparently there had been a lot of sightings. So that evening, we quite literally had nothing better to do. We went to Warminster, we perched ourselves on a hilltop, and hey presto, we saw these strange lights. We knew they weren't of an astronomical nature, you know, stars, planets, meteors, and so on. And that sparked the interest, you know. I there was an organisation mentioned in this book that was the British UFO Research Association. Foolishly, I thought I'll write to them and ask a few quick questions, and that will be the end of it. You know, I'll know everything I wanted to know. And here I am, nearly 30 years later, still looking for answers.
But
that is literally how it all began.
Wow. Hey, did you have any other close contacts after that?
The only thing that I could not explain was nowhere in particular. It was just driving home from work one evening. The area where I live is on a hill, and there's a large city called Leeds in the valley below us. Then on there's a hill opposite, and there's the airport and what have you. It's actually on the hill. It was just driving over. It was July of 1984, just a lovely summer's evening, finished work late. And it was, you know, nice red glow still in the sky, and I could see these lights in the sky that I knew shouldn't be there. I knew it wasn't Jupiter or whatever. So I managed to pull my car off the road and get a good look at these things. It was two sort of pearly white lights that hung totally motionless in the night sky. And I took off, you know, to get my camera. But before I could reach home, I pulled in again to take another look, and I could see the whole of Leeds in the valley below and the airport, you know, 10 or 12 miles in the distance. These lights were still there. They weren't high up in the sky. They were only, you know, they hit you right in the face. You didn't have to bend your neck to see these things. And, hey presto, before my very eyes, they just, pop, disappeared. And lots of other people over the sort of north of England that evening, you know, reported exactly the same thing. When I got, I only lived a few hundred yards from where I stopped the car. I got into the house and the telephone was already ringing. You know, colleagues coming home from work the same way that evening saw the same thing and so on. And try as I may, I couldn't find an explanation for them. I know it wasn't an aeroplane, a helicopter, and so on.
Right.
What it was, I honestly could not tell you.
Did anybody report it in the newspapers, or was it just kind of...
Absolutely. It made the local newspapers. Even local police officers in the city of Leeds who were on patrol that evening saw it. And whatever it was around the north of England for about a two-hour period. It came in from the coast, on the east coast of England, across through our county, and across into a neighbouring county, and seemed to be heading back out from whence it had came. So it was around for a couple of hours, and colleagues and I at the time in a local UFO group must have interviewed quite literally hundreds of people who saw it that evening. And, you know, I could see the airport from where I was stood. My first phone call was to the airport, and they knew nothing about it whatsoever. And could never figure out what exactly it was.
Now, given the distance that it was, what would you estimate the size might be compared to...
It was fairly large. I mean, because so many people saw it, and it appeared above a particular hillside, which was a suburb of the city of Leeds. So we were able to triangulate exactly where this thing was, because people saw it from all the way around it. And it, whatever it was fairly large. From where I was standing, it was less than 2 miles away. And you didn't have to look. It just hit you in the face as soon as I turned out from where I worked. Just one long straight road home, and there it was. You know, this is not in the middle of nowhere. You know, the city of Leeds is... I think it's the seventh largest city in England.
Wow.
So it's heavily populated. And like I said, even police officers on duty that night saw it. So
did they all describe the same shape?
Absolutely the same, exactly the same thing. And even years later, I was bumping into people and they said, oh yeah, I saw something back in July 1984. It was exactly the same thing.
Interesting. Well, you know, your country is really well known for its crop circles as well. Have you... also been involved with that phenomenon or not?
Absolutely. I mean, when the crop circle phenomena, before it really became sort of big news, there was a series of circles appeared in a place called Westbury.
Oh, yeah.
And a colleague and I, by the name of Walter Black, literally jumped in a can and headed off. And it was one of the hottest days of the year. We couldn't find the farmer who owned the field to get permission to go in. And we drove probably nearly 200 miles to get to this place. So we thought, well, we'll get in. So if people know anything about that particular area, where these fields were, there's a huge Iron Age fortification at the back. And on the edge of that is one of the white horses that's carved into the hillside. The Westbury White Horse.
Wow.
And in the crop fields below was one huge circle with four small satellites. So we went in and we made measurements, we took samples, and then there was a smaller circle stuck up in the corner of the field that no one had actually seen before. And at that time, to be honest with you, Lance, nobody was interested. No, absolutely no one was interested at all. I mean, we had this material, we took lots of photographs, we measured it precisely. There was local interest, but anywhere else, no one was the slightest bit interested. And so, you know, I came away thinking, well, I don't think this is anything that's perhaps of a man-made thing at that time. However, in subsequent years, I tend to think that some of the more spectacular pictograms and so on, you know, are possibly man-made. But I think certainly in those early days, there was something very peculiar. Now, whether it was associated with unknown phenomena or whether it was something to do with, you know, atmospheric physics, I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
But it was certainly an interesting experiment, nonetheless. It certainly wasn't caused by no thunderstorm or anything of that nature.
Some people describe a different feeling of energy when they're in the crop circles. Did you notice anything like that?
I didn't feel absolutely anything. You know, I know I have heard of people having this sense of being in there. Now, whether it's something that is in there or it's just something, you know, the fact that you're there, that the excitement gets to you, or, you know, you expect to feel something, I don't know. I mean, for example, that particular area of England also has many... ancient stone circles. I mean, Stonehenge is not that far away.
Oh, yeah.
I've been fortunate enough to stand in the middle of Stonehenge.
Oh, my.
It's all roped off now. You can't go into it. But I felt absolutely nothing.
Huh.
But there have been others who have believed to feel energies and so on. So I certainly felt nothing at all. What was interesting, though, about that particular day, Lance, while we were in the field, the police certainly paid us a visit.
Oh.
And while we're in the field, there was a military helicopter came very, very low over us and actually hovered at the same time. Now, whether they were just curious or what, I honestly don't know. But we certainly didn't hang around too long. We got the measurements, got the samples, and took the photographs, and we headed for home.
Oh, that's interesting. Some people say that the twigs of a real crop circle are just bent and not broken, and almost as if they've been melted.
All I can say is the ones that I examined personally were not broken. They were bent. They were bent, they were not broken. But having said that, I know a gentleman in the UK who's well known for his crop circle fakes.
Yes.
He will admit it, he admits this. He even gets paid to do it now.
Yes.
And he has replicated them exactly the same.
Yes, doesn't he claim that they have as much energy as the real ones?
Absolutely.
Yes, I've heard him on one of the other radio show a couple of times. He's pretty entertaining.
Absolutely. I mean, he has his tongue firmly in his cheek. He is an artist.
Yeah.
And he has made these formations. There's no doubt about it. And, they look... If there is a real crop circle phenomena there, I'm not saying there is or there isn't, with the fake ones, you certainly cannot tell the difference.
Interesting. Well, we're a clever race sometimes, not always.
Absolutely.
Now, you're probably best known, I may be wrong, but you're probably best known for your work on the alien autopsy. Is that correct?
It's probably correct, yes.
Okay. Would you tell us a little bit about how that started to come about?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, in 1993... I was the press officer for the British UFO Research Association.
Okay.
And I received a telephone call, like many others, from a chap called Ray Santilli. I didn't know this gentleman. Now, to begin with, he said, would your organization be interested in perhaps helping make a UFO documentary?
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah. You know, we'd worked on others. I mean, why not?
Right.
So, we had a few more telephone conversations, and without going into any specifics, and then he said, well, by the way, I actually have a film of the Roswell crash, is what Ray Santilli called it to give. He didn't say Roswell, he called it Roswell.
Oh, my.
So I said, well, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Show me. Show us. Say, no, I've never met you. You're just the voice on the end of a telephone.
Right.
With the greatest of respect. Show me.
Yeah.
So it was, yes, I can, no, I can, yes, I can, no, I can. This went on and off for quite some time. Now, we used to stage lectures in London, and it was about the time when the Travis Walton movie, Fire in the Sky, came out.
Oh.
And we hosted Travis and Mike Rogers in London for an evening lecture.
Oh.
And Ray Santilli's offices were quite nearby.
Uh-huh.
So I invited him to the lecture, and that's when I met him for the first time. He told me the story whereby he'd been in the States, met this mysterious cameraman, bought the Roswell footage, etc., etc. And I said, great, Ray, show me it. Yes, I can. No, I can't. Yes, I can. So this went on for about a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
I was quite literally, Ray had given me his business card. I was sat in my office one day and I'd received a copy of the Paul Davids produced Roswell movie.
Mm.
It was a small release in the UK, just on video only, and I'd been sent a copy for review purposes. And I just thought to myself, I wonder if that chap Santilli still claims to have this footage. So I rang him. And he said, yes, I do, Philip, but you don't believe me. I told him unless I saw the film, I couldn't believe him.
Right.
So I said, look, when can I see it? So he said, make an appointment to come and see me with my secretary, and I will show you it. I made the appointment there and then. So in early, I think it was around about March 1995, I drove to London, I met Ray in his office in London, and saw it. And I thought, well, at least film does exist. So by 1995, I was also Bufora's conference organiser.
Uh-huh.
I had a conference already organised for later that year, for August 1995. So I just said to Ray Santilli on the spot, will you show it at the conference? And he said, on one condition. I said, what's that? And he said, you help me research it. So I said, fine. And that's how I became involved.
Mm.
You know, it took about a year and a half, but I didn't see all the film in one go. Saw bits over a matter of a couple of months, but eventually saw it all. My thought on this, Lance, was if we show this at the conference, then it will get out into the public domain.
Yeah.
If it's out in the public domain, someone may come forward and say, that's my grandfather on there, or my father, and the film is real, or that's me, I'm one of the actors, and it's a fake. That was my reasoning behind it. And the conference was going to be a sellout anyway. We had the first two Russian scientists coming over to speak about UFOs, so that was going to be our selling point. Fortunately or unfortunately, whichever way you look at it, the alien autopsy took over things. And away it went. And the conference was a success. At that time, we must understand, Lance, Santilli had no plans for television or anything of that nature. So my plan did work. It got out into the public domain. But it took me a little longer than I expected to try and get to the bottom of things.
So how did you... I don't know anybody that has heard of or seen part of that crazy autopsy scene. And how did you research it, and is there any part of it that you couldn't explain?
I think today, I mean, all these years later, I mean, 13 years later, I think I can explain all of it.
Okay.
The first piece of film that Ray Santilli showed me is a piece called The Tent Footage. Now, this has never been shown on television. It only runs for a few minutes. The camera is static, so it doesn't move. You see a slab with a creature that's covered, so you basically see the head and the feet sticking out on the hands. The far side, there are two doctors, in inverted commas, in a white, just a white coat. You can see their faces, and they appear to be handling flesh of some kind. Occasionally, there's a dark figure moves in front of the camera, but he always has his back to you. Now, I forget the year, but there was a chap contacted me on email, and he said, I know something about the alien autopsy film. His name was called Keith Goodyear. Now, I phoned Keith, gave me a telephone number, and he started talking about the tent footage, which, bearing in mind, no one had seen on television. Told the story where he was in an office in the Midlands, in Milton Keynes in England, and this company called AK Music, he'd been there, and a telephone call came in from Ray Santilli. And he struck up a conversation, and they said, oh, is that the Santilli guy with the autopsy film? And they fell about laughing. And I said, we made it. It wasn't Santilli, we made it. And they gave Keith a piece of film, and he took it home. He'd seen, like everyone else, the alien autopsy film on TV, but he hadn't seen this piece. It was the tent footage. So a colleague of mine by the name of Tim Matthews and I tracked down AK Music. The owner was a chap called Keith Bateman. And Keith said, yeah, we made that particular film. Now, for quite a while, he wouldn't tell us, you know, whether Santilli asked him to make it or not. He would just admit to making it. So that was a fake. Sometime later, I re-interviewed Keith, and he said, well, you know, let me tell you the whole story. He said, Ray Santilli and I we used to be in the same business. We knew each other very good, and we used to have brainstorming sessions. We could come up with ideas. Keith's main business was making karaoke videos. He said, but we'd make virtually anything we thought we could make some money on. One of the technicians in the office one day had a book on Roswell. And Ray Santilli said, wouldn't it be great if we had some Roswell footage? So Keith Bateman and his colleagues at AK Music went away, made the tent footage. They filmed it in a barn on a farm. And used the pig's innards, and gave this to Ray Santilli. Now, it's quite dark, is this film, and he said, it's not quite good enough. Go away and give me a quote of how much it would cost to make some really good stuff. So Keith eventually came back with a quote for, I think it was something like £45,000. Santilli said, no, that's too expensive. Thank you very much. And away he went, and of course, that was the end of the story. Now, we knew for a fact that that was a fake, but Ray Santilli stuck to his guns and saying, yeah, it is. He said they'd pulled some kind of joke on him, but he maintained that the rest of the footage was authentic. Then, it was 3 years ago, I wrote an article for UFO magazine in England. And it was a front cover article, and at the end of the article, I asked, if you've got any information about the autopsy film, you know, contact me. There's my address, my phone number, my email. I was contacted by a gentleman by the name of Simon. And again, Simon said, I know something about this film. So I phoned him, and we eventually arranged to meet. And Simon said, it's actually a friend of mine who made the dummies, Ray Santilli. Sounded as if it was more than a friend. It sounded as if it was perhaps more of a brother-in-law or something, or certainly a family member, but he maintained it was a friend. And he said, do you know anyone that would be interested in it from a television point of view?
Hmm.
Now, certainly your listeners in the United States will probably be aware of the Fox show, Alien Autopsy Factor Fiction, which was produced by Bob Kiviat.
Okay.
So I put Simon in touch with Bob. And Bob eventually spoke to this chap's business manager, found out who he was. Now, Bob was negotiating for a TV special that, for whatever reason, never came off. Now, Simon wouldn't tell me who this chap was, wouldn't give me his name, but he gave me enough clues as to find who he was. Now, I'd found who this chap was, but I still needed it confirming. No one would confirm it for me.
Hmm.
Last year, we found out that Ray Santilli was involved with a movie company making a movie called Alien Autopsy. So I contacted the film company. They were called QWERTY Films in London. And I said to one of their executives, who's making your special effects? Who's doing the dummies? And they said, oh, it is John Humphreys. And he happens to be the man who made the dummies for Ray Santilli.
Oh, my.
I already had his name, so they confirmed it for me.
Oh, my.
So I went back to Bob Kiviat in the US and told him I knew the name, and he was dumbfounded. He'd signed a non-disclosure agreement at Bob, but, you know, the it was out.
Yeah.
Now, since then, Santilli has gone on record in a TV documentary here and said, well, most of the film that you see is a fake, but a little bit of it is true. I restored it. I hired John Humphreys to restore it. Well, John Humphreys is a sculptor, not a film restorer.
I see.
And when Ray shows frames from this particular, what he claims is the film, all you see is some men wearing white hats. It doesn't show any aliens or any wreckage or any flying saucers or anything. And what Ray forgot to tell his viewers is that this John Humphreys had spoken at length to Bob Kiviat in the United States, and I told Bob everything. He was. I think the X-rays, and excuse me if I've got this wrong, but we could say it was going to turn Queen's evidence. He was going to rat him out, basically.
Yeah.
You know, and so he's running scared, is Ray, I think. But this, unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever way you look at it, the film is a fake.
Mm. So you actually were the one to debunk it.
Absolutely. Sense. Yeah. I mean, Bob's done a new television production now. It's called Alien Autopsy, The True Story. So he tells of its early roots of how the film first came out.
Uh-huh.
And then it tells you a little bit about how the tent footage was exposed as a fake.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, the recent findings with John Humphreys and so. So it's like a potted history of the whole thing. But at the end of the day, we show that it is indeed a fake.
Hmm. Well, I imagine that's an interesting film nonetheless.
It is indeed. I mean, Ray's admitted that they planned it meticulously.
Yeah.
And that's why there's nothing in there that stands out as an obvious fake. What we have to remember, and some people may not know this, but there are actually two separate autopsy films, only one of which has been released on TV and video.
Mm.
And I've seen both of them.
Mm.
The other one that's not been released has slight differences to it.
Huh.
And Santilli admitted, I only ever saw it once, that there are mistakes in it. That's why they didn't release that one. You know, whether they're wearing a digital watch or whatever, I don't know. But there is a mistake in it somewhere that if you watched it often enough, you would pick up as a fake.
Now, you've actually held quite a prominent position within the British UFO Research Association as their director of investigations.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How long did you hold that position for?
I was director of investigations for 3 years.
Okay.
I'd been with BUFORA for about 10 years. I served as a director of various things for 10 years. I was their press officer.
Hmm.
Extremely successful conference organizer. I was one of their field investigators as well, and eventually was their director of investigations. And it was a position I held for 3 years and enjoyed immensely.
Mm. Were you able to investigate anything that you personally could not invalidate, or that as far as
without hesitation, Lance? I mean, long before I was with BUFORA as a director.
No.
Now, I live in the north of England, and here in Yorkshire, I was contacted. It was the summer of 1980. There's been several things, but this is one that always stands out in my mind. A lady telephoned me and said, myself and my children have seen this thing in the field, Philip, but you won't believe us. You know, you will not believe us. I said, well, try me. Now, she was married to a coal miner.
Uh-huh.
Now, my father was a coal miner for nearly 40 years, so uh-huh. I know this type of person. So, took some details. It's not that far from where I live. It's about, I would say, about 10 miles from where I live. It's outside of a town called Normanton in West Yorkshire. So I went to visit this lady. She's called Mrs. Westerman. She was in her mid-40s. And it was a summer's day. And the children had been playing outside of the house. She's playing the ball game. You know, it was the school holidays. And the ball had gone up in the air. And they saw this aeroplane, in inverted commas. It came down at an angle, stopped in mid-air, and dropped into some fields that were adjacent to where they lived. Mm. They lived in a cul-de-sac. They run into the house. It was just after lunch. Mrs. Westerman was actually washing up, doing the dishes. And I said, you know, Mum, this aeroplane's crashed in the field. So she came out her front door. She could see over these fields. And it wasn't no aeroplane. It was, she described it as a Mexican hat-shaped thing. You know, or a tank without the gun turret.
Huh.
So there was five children, so she took them towards this. Now, at the end of the road, there's some fields. She went down a small dip, and she lost sight of it there. Come up the other side, and the fence borders the field, and this thing is still sat there on the ground, but now there are several tall men outside it.
Really?
They're all in one-piece white suits. They had mittens, not gloves, but mittens,
So
they couldn't see the boots on them. There was a wedge on the boots, and they had some kind of thing covering their face, and they seemed to be holding something in their hand and waving it over the ground.
Huh.
Now, the children weren't frightened. She was. They were trying to climb over the fence, but she held them back.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Yep. These beings walked to the reverse of this, the back of this thing. It rose silently, stopped in midair again, and was gone in a flash from whence it had came.
Wow.
And this was in broad daylight. This was the summer. Just nearby is a very, very busy, what we call the motorway. You probably call it a freeway or a highway. One of the main link roads between the north of England and London. They're always busy. Nobody else reported anything.
Were they human-sized?
They were humanoid. They seemed to be fairly tall men, you know, two arms, two legs.
Wow.
Couldn't see any facial features. They had a one-piece coverall, boiler suit, we'll call it what you want, but they were so close they could see that they weren't wearing gloves. It was mittens.
Wow.
And there was even a wedge shape to the bottom of their boots.
Interesting.
I mean, I went to the exact location. They never called it a flying saucer or a spaceship or spacemen or aliens. You know, I've grown up with this type of family all my life. She wouldn't allow a photograph to be taken. Didn't want any publicity. Didn't think anyone would ever believe her.
Right.
You know, and just was, you know, they're a down-to-earth family, you know, in a modest house, just reported what they had seen. There were some electricity pylons bordering the field. There's a local electricity power station nearby. It never made a noise. It wasn't a helicopter. You know, a helicopter wouldn't land there anyway. You know, it wouldn't go anywhere near the electricity pylons. And, of course, everybody knows what a noise a helicopter makes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and what do you say? What do you say? This lady was either telling the truth or she wasn't.
Right. Yeah.
And I have no reason whatsoever to say she wasn't telling the truth. And I cannot find an explanation for it, no matter how I try.
Interesting. Well, of course, there are some theories that we, at this time, either the United States or a multinational conglomerate, have developed technologies which actually mimic ufology, and you know, that we're now capable of doing things like that. So some claim that we are almost up to speed with some of these flying discs.
Yeah, I mean, the theory is called the federal hypothesis.
Yeah.
You know, that whatever these flying vehicles are, they're man-made. But with the greatest of respect, Lance, you'd fly them around Area 51.
Right.
You know,
right.
You wouldn't fly them over Normanton in West Yorkshire.
Right.
And you certainly wouldn't land one there.
No, of course not.
You know, there would
not
be no, it is a nowhere place of any distinction, you know, why on earth would you do that?
Yeah.
It just doesn't add up.
Does the British UFO Research Association have, is it as secretive as our own here in America? Because it seems that there's an incredible attempt to keep these kinds of things from the public. Does the British agency work pretty transparently, or do they keep things from the public, or how does?
Are you talking about the research group, or are you talking about the officialdom, the military?
Well, yes, the military.
There's been a change over these last few years. Up until recent times, the one thing we didn't have was a Freedom of Information Act.
Hmm.
It did not exist. The Labour government brought one in, I think it was 2 years ago.
Wow.
So now you can request information. Now, some of it has come out into the public domain. The Ministry of Defence, whether you want to believe them or not, are actively trying to make it easier to get this type of information into the public domain. It's there in our National Archives. So they are trying, but they have a limited budget like anything else.
Mm.
It's not a top priority.
Right.
I think it's been helped by certainly people like Nick Pope. For those that don't know, Nick Pope, during the mid-1990s, was actually employed by the Ministry of Defence as part of his work was to look into UFO reports. Now, Nick is still employed at the MOD, but he does something completely different. He has moved on. Nick, as a result, became interested in the subject. He's a well-known now UFO researcher in his own right and published a number of books and so on. But I think, Nick and his involvement certainly helped in that respect. And so they are secretive. It's the nature of government to be secret. You know, I think we are more secretive than perhaps even the United States, Lance. I mean, we have a thing called the Official Secrets Act. And you have to sign it. Now, it covers everything. It's even an official secret to know how many tea bags they use in the Houses of Parliament.
Oh, my. Yeah.
That's how archaic and out of date it was. It was brought in during the First World War. I mean, a friend of mine, for example, used to work in a textile mill.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things they made in the textile mill was cloth for military dress uniforms. And as a result, he had to sign the Official Secrets Act, you know. But the Freedom of Information Act has helped. But yes, you know, the powers that be do keep things secret. It is their nature to do so.
Yes, it does seem that way. You have another really fascinating area that you were researching, and it had to do with the Soviet era UFO phenomenon and the Tungsten blast in 1908. What was that all about?
The way this all came about, Lance, was in 1987, there was a UFO landing in the Soviet Union.
Uh-huh.
It was widely reported. Even the official Soviet press agency of TASS released the information.
Uh-huh.
For some reason, I was interviewed by a number of Soviet newspapers. They phoned me at home and telephoned, you know, and interviewed me.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, I started getting letters from both UFO researchers and just ordinary members of the public in Russia saying, you know, what they'd seen, what their research was, and so on. Half of which I couldn't read because it wasn't in English. It was all in Russian. So a lot of it I just had to file. But then I became in contact with a colleague of mine by the name of Paul Stonehill. Paul lives in California, but Paul is originally from the Ukraine. He just changed his name. And he's a UFO researcher. So Paul and I started to exchange material. We were commissioned at one point to write a small, what we call a coffee table book.
Mm-hmm.
We called it the Soviet UFO file. It came out a few years ago. Pretty successful.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as good as we'd have liked. And the material still kept coming in. We built up a number of contacts in the former Soviet Union. Paul had, and so had I. So we decided to collaborate, and we published a book. It's called Mysterious Sky, available on Amazon if anyone would want a copy, Paul Stonehill and Philip Mantle. And it basically chronicles Soviet UFO research from ancient times, literally ancient times, right the way through up to modern-day Russia.
Oh.
And everything in between. And of course, one of the things that no one can deny that did happen was the blast in Tunguska in 1908.
Hmm.
It's well documented. It's scientifically documented. The photographs are there. It's just a question of what happened. I mean, the blast was so great. It's approximately, I believe, I'm not sure of the exact mileage, but several thousand miles from where I actually live, right? There's a well-known photograph of one of the churches in Leeds on the night of the Tunguska blast, and it's like daylight as a result of the blast several thousand miles away.
Wow.
That's how big it was. If that blast were to happen now over a major city, be it in the US or in the UK, it would be devastating. It would kill millions. It is fortunate that it exploded in the Tunguska region of Siberia, basically in the middle of nowhere. It's the trees and swamps, and that's about all there was, and a few natives.
Huh.
Now, the curious thing about the object that the natives saw coming in was that it changed course.
Ah.
It didn't just come from A to B and then boom. It didn't impact either. It didn't explode at ground, hitting the ground. It exploded in the atmosphere.
Ah.
Pretty much like an atomic bomb does.
Wow.
An atomic bomb does not explode on impact. So when you look down on the devastation of the trees, they're rayed out in a radio pattern because the blast came from above. And, of course, many of the witnesses saw this fireball coming in, and it changed direction. Now, you know, meteors and so on don't do that.
No, no.
Now, it wasn't investigated for a number of years because of its location. I mean, it was, you know, the back end of nowhere. Professor Kulik was the first to get there a few years later, and he went through tremendous hardships to get there. But there's still a Tunguska Society now that goes out once a year and still research it, and still no one knows to this very day. Radiation was present because some of the trees that survived, you can see the mutations in their growth and that kind of thing. One of several of the UFO researchers still living in the Soviet Union, or I'll call it that now, Russia, the Ukraine, and its associated countries, believe it was, in fact, you know, not of this earth. It was indeed a UFO that exploded. You know, it was in trouble, and it just blew up.
Wow.
And they put forward their theories for it. Whatever it turns out to be, the Tunguska event did happen. This is not hearsay. If you want, you can go there. You can still see the devastation. It is still there, you know, almost 100 years later. And it's there for all to see. The evidence is there. It's just a matter of what does it all add up to. But it's a fact, you know, there are books just on Tunguska. We sort of touch on the main points of it and some of the theories put forward to try and explain it in just one chapter. That's about all we can cover.
Wow.
Like I say, one of the reasons for writing Mysterious Sky was to emphasise a number of things. One, that whatever the UFO subject it is, it doesn't recognise any international boundaries or borders.
Mm-hmm.
It is everywhere. Mm-hmm. It is not something that's new. It has been gone throughout history. And also to pay tribute to the Soviet researchers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have to remember under some of the Soviet regimes, it was quite literally punishable by death to be involved in UFO research.
Mm.
So that's why a lot of it originally was underground. They literally risked their lives.
Wow.
So, you know, the book is a tribute to their work as well as the subject itself. And well worth a read, if I don't mind saying so myself.
Give us the name of the book again.
It's Mysterious Sky. And it's published by Philip Mantle and Paul Stonehill, and it's available on Amazon.
Well, that sounds wonderful. I'm going to get that one.
Okay.
Of all the research you've done, what do you think is the most convincing or the most unusual event that you've researched?
I was fortunate enough to get involved in abduction research.
Ooh.
Now, this came about quite by chance again. Colleagues and I, we set up something very, very simple. It was just an answer phone service. We called it a UFO hotline.
Hmm.
But because I was Bufora's director of investigation, you could ring in, and if we weren't available to take your call, you could leave a message. And we had a network, pretty much like MUFON do in the US and other groups, around the country. And we could get someone there pretty quickly if need be.
Wow.
Literally, the first call on the answer machine was, from a local lady.
Uh-huh.
And talked to you about a couple of sightings. I went to see her, but it wasn't just some sightings. It was actually an ongoing series of experiences of abductions.
Wow.
Now, we knew of one or two in the UK that were, you know, well-known, but we certainly didn't have a lot of them. Now, this young lady, and I'm not being disrespectful, wasn't an educated person by any stretch of the means. She was just a normal, average woman, just a housewife with a partner and a young daughter. These experiences have been ongoing for years.
Wow.
From the age of 16. She thought, at one point she thought, I'm going nuts. Mm. I'm going mad. Mm. She went to see a doctor. He referred her to the hospital. They gave her some medication. They said the medication will make them go away. It didn't. Mm. You know, she told them in no uncertain terms what they could do with their medication. It didn't work, you know.
Yeah.
Her mother even had an experience, and even her daughter.
Huh.
And what was interesting was that I was very, as a result, became very friendly with abduction researcher Bud Hopkins in New York.
Hmm.
And there were some of the things that Bud was only just publishing in things like the MUFON Journal and what have you, which are not widely available, that this lady was saying exactly the same kind of thing. Now, how does, you know, an abductee in America and an abductee here in the UK come out with the same type of thing?
Mm.
When they've never met, she's not read the literature, she was unfamiliar with all this kind of thing, and it was fascinating. Absolutely, she talked about having, you know, phantom pregnancies, the alien hybrid children,
really,
et cetera. I mean, I could have written a book just about this lady. Her name is Jane.
You know, that's becoming quite a big thing over here.
Yeah, no, this is the first person that I'm aware of in the UK to report this kind of thing, which was long before books like Intruders came out and so on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I sent transcripts of my interviews over to Bud, and he came back and asked, you know, said after this, and he came up with it. So we collaborated a little bit on this.
Uh-huh.
As a little aside issue, I took Jane to see a psychiatrist, and he gave her a checkup. She wasn't nuts. She wasn't suffering from any syndromes.
Uh-huh.
You know, she was just like you or I.
Mm.
And what do you say to that? I mean, as a result, other abductees I spoke to, I mean, we have a famous incident in the UK where the abductee was actually a police officer in his patrol car on duty at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
It's Police Constable Alan Godfrey. Just finishing night shift when he came across this thing in the road. It's like a big spinning top, blocked the road. He couldn't get through on his radio to the headquarters. He drew it in his notebook. The next thing he knew, he's 700 yards down the road, no recollection of restarting his patrol car. And he looked back and this thing had gone.
Wow.
There was a period of missing time and so on. He was in uniform in the patrol car at the time.
Wow.
And skeptics will always tell people, oh, it's always nutcases. They're always in the middle of nowhere when these things happen. You know, this was a serving police officer with commendations against his name. You know, well respected. I've met him several times, and he will argue with anyone that what he saw that day on the road was real.
Wow.
So, you know, and I published a book. Obviously, not a plug. So I don't know if it's still in print.
Oh,
it's called Without Consent, and it's the one and it's the only book so far that deals with abductions purely in the UK.
Uh-huh.
It's only in the dots. All the abduction accounts in there are from the UK. And it was, you know, I'm still interested in that aspect of things, but it's a fascinating subject to become involved with.
Do any of the people who have been abducted, have their abductors told them what they're being done, what's being done to them, or why?
No.
No.
But very little. There was a sort of an underlying trend at one point. I think that's changed somewhat in recent years, but it was... It was, rather than tell them, it was hinted at and intimated and clues, and it was to do with environmental issues, the fact that we as a species were poisoning the earth,
mm-hmm.
and that these beings, for want of a better word, were concerned about what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And as a little side issue, there was a number of the abductees, as a result, became interested in environmental issues.
Mm.
Directly afterwards.
And their children are often abducted too, aren't they?
That's right. I mean, Jane's daughter, for example, reported an incident. I thought she was a bit too young at the time for me to be dealing with. It wasn't my area of experience. I thought she needed to see someone of a professional nature. But I made a note of what she was saying and just left it at that. But she certainly seemed to be involved. And her mum as well. I mean, her mum lived at a different location,
mm-hmm.
and she had this encounter one night, and rightly or wrongly, she said, it's not me you want, it's our Jane.
Yeah.
Thanks, yeah. Mum. You know, but so there seemed to be something across three generations there.
Yes. Mm. Some are theorizing that those children are now the what they call the indigos and the crystals that have advanced powers as well.
Well, I thought they've been nicknamed also, I think, the star children.
Yes, the star children. Yes.
Yeah. And certainly Jane had many, I'll call them experiences, because I don't really know what the correct word is to use, where she wasn't pregnant in real life. I mean, she you know, there was no extended abdomen, you know, and the menstrual cycle wasn't interfered with, but when these experiences happened, she would be pregnant and the fetus would be removed at a very early age.
Yes.
And she was sown offspring that were half alien and half human. Now, the way Jane described these beings, these children, if you like, were like cheap dolls. You know, if you bought a cheap doll from a cheap store and the hair's all funny and it's not quite right.
Yeah.
They looked something like that.
Oh.
That's the way she described them.
Really?
And, you know, there were many. I have a huge file on these experiences with Jane. And that's just one of many.
Huh. Well, you know, I don't want to change the subject, but Whitley Strieber came out with his book, The Graves, recently, and it seems like the theory that's loosely woven through that one is that it's a program to help save the Earth by 2012 and save the Zetas who are dying because they have bred the emotional body out of their cloning. They've cloned it out, and they're dying. So, you know, who knows if there's even a thread of truth to any of this, you know, and there's certainly people who have come up with much more sinister ideas about these beings, but they don't seem to be hurting anybody, and we do have problems here on Earth, and we do need some help. So, you know, I'm hoping that they're just a benevolent experience.
Whatever. I mean, if Whitney's right, then we'll all find out in 2012.
Yeah, exactly.
And what I would say is that... again, you know, there are skeptics out there. What I would say about the vast majority of people who have these experiences, they come from all walks of life, all incomes, you know, all educational brackets. The vast majority of them do not want any publicity.
Yeah.
They do not want to go on the record.
Yeah.
They have perhaps more to lose than they have to gain by doing so.
Right.
And they are as puzzled as everyone else. I did a little poll of some of the abductees here, and I must admit it was only a small one, but I asked them what they believed was the nature and origin of their experience.
Uh-huh.
Most of them said, don't know, Philip. I don't know. This is what I can remember.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it was. Some are quite categorical, yes, it was aliens. Some believe it was some kind of spiritual experience.
Uh-huh.
So even the people themselves that are involved don't know what's happening to them. And so, you know, we as outsiders, you know, it's even more difficult for us to try and come to some, you know, definitive conclusion. But what I will say, again, by and large, I found them to be normal, rational, sane individuals who were not out to make money. They weren't out for their 5 minutes of fame or anything of that nature. Either a one-off experience had happened or a series of bizarre experiences had happened, and they just wanted to get to the bottom of it. They wanted to know what had happened, and that was as simple as that.
Do you think that it's smarter for people to try and confront these situations and speak about them openly, just to find out how many other people there are out there that are having this experience?
Absolutely. I mean, when Jane first called, for example, and we're going back again to the late 1980s here in the UK, we knew of only a handful or so of abduction accounts in Britain, and we knew we were only scratching, you know, the tip of the iceberg. So thankfully, because one or two individuals like Police Constable Godfrey that I mentioned and others were quite prepared to risk the ridicule and so on and go on the record, it encouraged others to do the same. Again, most of them would come forward, you know, on the proviso that the names were released and so on, which they never were. You know, that was kept quiet. But nonetheless, we got the information. The names and things like that going to the public domain didn't really matter. But we were able to show that, yeah, you know, we can handle this, we can deal with this, we can research this. And more came out of the woodwork. I also think people like Nick Pope becoming involved, the late Dr. John Mack, you know, also becoming involved, mm-hmm. gave the subject an air of authority, of like, and a respectability. That's probably the word I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever you want to say about Dr. John Mack, you know, he was a Harvard professor, certainly not a hack or a lunatic, you know, and it gave that respectability to the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, researchers are perhaps reaping the benefit of that now. So more and more people have come forward and you know, fair play to them.
Well, it does seem like, you know, there's a much different atmosphere right now, and largely because people like you are opening up and talking about it, and, you know, you seem to be a very intelligent and relatively normal person, and you're describing experiences that many people have had and share, and, you know, I'd be willing to bet that many of the listeners will be nodding their heads and say, oh, yes, I had that experience myself.
Ooh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's been a shift as far as the media is concerned as well, Lance. I think I noticed certainly during the 1990s that certainly here in the UK there was more serious media coverage of the subject. Mm. It used to be looked upon as a silly season subject here, you know, something to poke fun at when there was no soccer being played and, you know, the politicians had gone on holiday and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, because of people that I've mentioned previously, it did give it that air of respectability. So the media played its part in it as well, which in turn encouraged more people to become involved, to take the subject seriously, which in turn encourages more people to come forward and put their statements on the record.
Mm.
And you know, it's a circular movement in that respect. And long may it last.
So I'm just going to ask you one more question. If you had to say whether that there were or were not unidentified flying objects in the world, for whatever reason, what would be your answer?
Yes, that is.
Okay.
I mean, it's simple. I've often used the example, if we were to take the flying saucers to court, we could prove they exist.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. If you look at any way any court case is worked, you present the evidence, you present the eyewitnesses, and we can present the eyewitnesses, we can present photographic, we can present film, we can present physical evidence, and so on.
Yes.
And the judge would stand up and say, yes, they're there. It's just a question of what they are, where do they come from, and so on.
Exactly.
There's no question about it.
Wonderful. Well, now, do you have a website, Philip, that people can go and do some research?
Yeah, absolutely, Lance. Now, I would like to draw the listeners' attention to a new website we started early in the year. It's called UFO Data.
Okay.
And it's www.ufodata.co.uk. So by myself and my colleagues, Russell Callahan and Michael Buckley. And we also publish our own magazine.
Oh.
It's called UFO Data. You won't find it in the newsstands. It's on subscription only.
Okay.
So if you want to go to the website, it's there. It's in print. And Russell used to work on UFO magazine with his father-in-law, Graham Birtle.
Oh.
Sadly, Graham died 3 years ago and the magazine closed. So we started it up again. We started it this year. We're into our issue number 5. It's bi-monthly. So it's about all things ufological from around the world. So
wow.
If you want to go to ufodata.co.uk, please feel free to do so.
Wonderful. Well, Philip, thank you so much for being with us. It was really a treat and a delight, and I wish you just the best in your research. And I hope to have you back sometime and see what new experiences you found out.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Lance, hope to speak to you again.
I'm going to check out your magazine, too, because that sounds like a wonderful way to become informed.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks again, Philip.
Good evening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.